From KUAZ News in Tucson, I'm Julie Burock, and this is Arizona Spotlight. The University of Arizona is taking a leading role in the greater integration of technology into surgical education and practice. This morning, we'll have a special report on the new Arizona Simulation Technology and Education Center, also known as AZTEC. KUAZ's Bill Mortimer will have a feature on service dogs trained to help people with physical disabilities. We'll take you on a tour of the Copper Queen Mine in Bisbee and the commentary of Baxter Black. That's coming up later in the program, but first. The University of Arizona is revolutionizing medical education and training with the Arizona Simulation Technology and Education Center, or AZTEC, located at University Medical Center. It's a facility for developing simulation training in the medical sciences. Here, students learn surgical techniques before they practice on real patients. Dr. Alan Hamilton developed the simulation mannequin, which resembles a human being and has the ability to mimic various kinds of symptoms that medical students will have to diagnose. AZTEC is improving medical training here in Southern Arizona and across the country. Dr. Hamilton.
The idea here is that people would come here to learn techniques, learn how to do things, get themselves buffed up before they go out and practice on humans. In the past, you know, it was kind of hit or miss. Now we're saying, you know, in terms of errors and in terms of what's acceptable, we would much rather approximate more of an industrial engineering model, sort of like the aviation industry. People don't actually crash airplanes to get the practice. So people shouldn't actually have to hurt or kill patients to get the practice.
In class today are two third-year medical students. This is their second class after only receiving an introduction to the simulation course.
Let's go ahead back.
They get real nervous at the beginning because it's so much like a human being that it takes a while for them to sort of settle down and calm down and figure out that, you know, they got to take things stepwise and pace themselves. So today will be kind of a repeat for them. And what we're looking for is that they've sort of learned the procedures a little quicker and they're moving along a little bit more methodically.
Students in the AZTEC class practice all types of procedures, from putting in intravenous lines, inserting a Foley catheter in the bladder, intubating and inserting chest tubes. They're given a variety of scenarios that they will have to respond to and diagnose.
What we're looking for is, do they approach this like we would a trauma resuscitation? Are they really thinking about, you know, what labs do they want? How do they order them? How fast do they order them? How much are they moving from one diagnosis to the next? So we log all this stuff on so we can actually go back and say, you know, you didn't get an IV going until this guy was 7 or 8 minutes into his experience, and that's not fast enough.
The simulation mannequin mimics the scenarios that Dr. Hamilton inputs into the computer, which controls the mannequin. He also communicates with the students through a speaker positioned in the mannequin's mouth while he watches the students on a closed-circuit television system as they assess and diagnose the patient.
Because it's a kind of a robot on a computer, I can tell the computer, you know, let's not make this a healthy 21-year-old athlete. Let's make this a brittle 81-year-old little granny who's coming in and has past history of lots of other medical problems. So we can sort of tweak it. And then bit by bit, we throw in more and more and more curves. So today, I know that we'll be throwing in some more cardiac problems than they had in the past. So that'll sort of be a background complication that we're thinking about adding in.
During this particular class, the mannequin will simulate a trauma case. Here's the scenario. The patient or simulation mannequin is a 21-year-old who has been in a car accident. The airbag has deployed, the steering wheel is broken, and it took 30 minutes to extricate the patient from the car. Also, the patient was inebriated at the scene.
Sir, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can.
Are you okay? You having any difficulty breathing?
While the students assess the patient, Dr. Hamilton is sitting at the computer in the next room, controlling the mannequin, all the while watching the students on a television screen.
Can you take some deep breaths for me?
Dr. Hamilton is waiting for the students to diagnose that the patient has a buildup of fluid around the heart and will have to perform a pericardiocentesis, which is a procedure used for trauma, where the doctor draws fluid away from the heart. But that fluid can also stop the heart. So if the students don't know how to do the procedure, the patient could die.
So one of the things you have is the patient is bleeding, okay? You want to be more aggressive about your fluid resuscitation. So
the Aztec class is part of students' basic surgical training. It runs every 6 weeks, so eventually every medical student will go through the class. By the end of the 6 weeks, the students will have learned sophisticated procedures. Dr. Hamilton says the training is paying off.
They can actually do very sophisticated trauma resuscitations. We'll take them through gunshot wounds to the chest with damage to the great vessels. And, you know, the students, we've heard very nice feedback from people about, hey, your students really know what they're doing when they get to a code or get to a big trauma resuscitation. So we sort of feel like this is paying off. And there's no doubt for the students, they love the idea that they're practicing in a way that doesn't hurt patients. Almost all of the medical students are extremely concerned about the idea that for them to learn and poke with a needle and move it around and do all that stuff is very disconcerting to a patient. So they love the idea of coming down here and just getting their skills down and not having to worry about hurting somebody doing it.
Aztec is a collaborative initiative between the University of Arizona, the U of A College of Medicine, University Medical Center, and Arizona State University. As well, Aztec has partnered with other companies to develop the next generation of surgical instruments.
We happen to be very fortunate there were a number of bioindustrial partners that wanted to team up with the U of A because they've heard about us in the planetary sciences, optical sciences, telemedicine. So they were real keen on linking up with our medical school because we're really advanced into telecommunications and how telecommunications affect medicine. So they thought, you know, this is kind of all fits together. The idea of making an operating room that could be accessed remotely so I could theoretically coach somebody through surgery 250 miles away or 1,000 miles away, or let's say in a battlefield I could get up to the front with the medics so that, you know, I could actually say, no, that guy's got a lacerated artery, let's go ahead and take care of that right now, or out into the field for the paramedic where the doctor could literally be at the scene of the crash but still at the hospital but giving the paramedical personnel a lot more support and a lot more ability to carry out stuff.
Dr. Hamilton believes one day the Aztec program will be part of every medical and nursing school curriculum and eventually will be part of every subspecialty. To find out more about the Aztec facilities at the University of Arizona, you can log on to www.aztec.arizona.edu. Coming up on Arizona Spotlight, KUAZ's Bill Mortimer will have a feature story on service dogs trained to help people with physical disabilities. You're listening to Arizona Spotlight on KUAZ. Disabled people throughout southern Arizona are getting around a little easier these days, thanks to the volunteer staff at Handy Dog Incorporated. KUAZ's Bill Mortimer reports.
At one time or another, we've all seen a handicapped person accompanied by a guide dog. The dog is usually a lab or German shepherd. It leads the individual around obstacles or stops for traffic. Enter the service dog, an animal that does so much more. Here in Tucson, we found Handy Dogs Incorporated, a nonprofit organization led by its director of training, Phyllis Allen. Phyllis, Handy Dogs offers a totally different approach to animal assistance.
The owners get to pick their own dog, whatever dog they want, and we actually are training the owners rather than training the dogs, which makes it challenging sometimes, but it has works out very well because the owners not only know how to train their own dog, they two of them together go through the ups and the downs and the highs and the lows, and they are able to continue training their dog once they finish our program.
I understand that Handy Dogs has actually been in Tucson for over 30 years, providing training classes for physically disabled people and their dogs, helping individuals to maintain their independence and a better quality of life. Phyllis, what would you say is your biggest reward in this work?
Seeing the owners who come in have a disability or health issues and who kind of just blossom, being able to train their own dog to help them. So there's not only the aspect of ending up with a trained dog, but also the social aspect.
This must take an enormous amount of patience and energy on everyone's part. Tell us about the training.
The dogs learn all kinds of different skills, how to get along with each other, how to get along with people, how to have good manners, both at home and out in public, and also how to assist their owners, whether that's picking up items for them, opening doors, going to get help, alerting them to the telephone or the doorbell or their name, helping them take on and off their clothes, all anything that a dog is physically capable of doing, the owner can train that dog to help them with.
Now let's go back for a moment. The method seems a bit foreign to me. I've always thought of the dog as already trained by someone else and then purchased by the disabled person. You operate very differently.
Kind of a unique way of doing it, but it started here actually about 30 years ago. And like you say, most of the service dogs are trained by an organization and then placed with a person. But there are many, many more people who can use a service dog than there are service dogs available. So a lot of the people that come to us might have to wait like years to get a service dog if they even qualified. And as I said before, the fact that they actually learn how to train themselves is invaluable to them.
And what about breeds? Because there's another mindset, well, it was a certain breed that was a service dog. I don't think that's the case here because I see a poodle here, and that is not what I immediately think of as a service dog.
That's exactly right. When we have dogs in this program, everywhere from the size of a poodle all the way up to like an Irish wolfhound. And the beauty of this is that not everybody wants to have like a lab or a golden retriever. They might not want a dog like that. So they can bring in the dog of their choice.
Let's bring in Janet McMullen. She is a volunteer trainer here at Handy Dogs. Janet, when you meet your new student and their companion pet for the first time, what do you feel is your biggest challenge?
The biggest challenge is probably me. I have to learn, of course, from Phyllis exactly what training methods we use. We use a clicker positive training method, so it's a happy experience for everybody. And I am so blessed to be able to see people who are more disabled than myself gain independence and overcome the obstacles that they need to overcome and have such a wonderful working and friendship relationship with their dogs. It is so tremendously rewarding that it's much better than a paycheck.
You talked about your own limitations. You have a service dog yourself, and that is the poodle we see here.
Exactly, yes. My back is fused. I'm unable to reach all the way down to the ground. So my miniature poodle, Lacey, she and I went through the program here, and we are now certified, and she helps me tremendously by picking up things. She stands up on her hind legs and hands me whatever I need, from something as large as my cane to as small as a pair of socks that I drop while I'm loading the washing machine. She's a big help.
Certainly an enlightening experience. Thank you, Janet. And thanks to the director of Handy Dogs Incorporated, Phyllis Allen. For more information on Handy Dogs, go online to www.handi-dogs.org. For Arizona Spotlight, I'm Bill Mortimer.
Up next on Arizona Spotlight, we'll take a tour of the Copper Queen Mine in Bisbee. This is Arizona Spotlight on KUAZ. It's a typical summer day in Bisbee, Arizona. By mid-afternoon, threatening clouds appear and monsoon rains start to fall. A group of about 30 visitors, including myself and Jim, our producer, are gearing up to witness Bisbee's most popular tourist attraction. We don bright yellow slickers, white hard hats, and a battery-operated light. We step into a small train, straddling the seat in single-file fashion, realizing that we're about to see a historic locality that once made Bisbee the biggest town in the West between St. Louis and San Francisco. The train starts to roll, and we begin our journey into the Copper Queen Mine.
Okay, folks, this mine's pretty old at about 120 years. So most everything I'm going to tell you in here today is of the older mining days. But I will bring you up to date a little bit, even talk about my mining days as well. Now, this mine started in 1879, and it operated until 1943. If you hold your lights down, please. All the other mines in this area operated until 1975 when they shut down. And there's some 35 of them in this area. So there was extensive mining done here. You just don't see it from the surface.
That's Jerry Leonard, our tour guide. He was a miner for 20 years. Now his job is giving daily tours. As we travel about 700 feet into the mine, we're surrounded by rock. The cold hits us immediately and we're surrounded by darkness. It's a constant 47 degrees in the mine. As you shine your light all around, you realize you're traveling through a tunnel of essentially gray and brown rock with mixed hues of red, gold, and white. We pull into our first stop, get out of the train, and Jerry leads us up a wood staircase into the stope, or the working area. He explains the mine's complexities and how it was worked in the early days.
Right up in this mountain, there's 143 miles of tunnels like you just came in. There's over 100 stopes where they mined out big bodies of high-grade ore. Now, throughout the whole district, some 4.6 square miles, there's about 2,300 miles of tunnels. So a lot of mining did go on.
For years and years I rambled, drank for wines and gambled.
The history of the Copper Queen is as rich as the mine itself. In 1887, Jack Dunn, an Army scout, found ore. Dunn was unable to leave his Army duties, so he hired George Warren to prospect the land and establish a claim. Warren, a heavy drinker, lost Dunn's claim in a saloon on his way to the Mule Mountains. He soon found new backers and filed claims. Not long after, George Warren, too, would lose his claim.
Right across the street over here is a place called Brewery Gulch. I don't know if you folks have been over there yet, but right up that gulch there was 47 bars. Those guys like to drink a little bit, do a little gambling. And George, he was one of them. And the story goes that he raced a horse on foot, and he had bet this claim. Well, of course, he lost, and it cost him $40 million. Pretty expensive whiskey that day.
Miners in the town were called the Iron Men of Bisbee. In the early days, miners were only equipped with hand tools, 3 candles a day, a pick and shovel, a 2-foot drill steel, and a 4-pound hammer. They worked 10 to 12-hour shifts for $3.50 a day. Miners routinely risked their lives.
You have to drill a series of holes in this rock, load it with powder, and blast it out of there. Otherwise, it's not coming out. Now, those guys in the early days, they could drill about 1.25 feet an hour, but that was probably early in the morning. You swing a 4-pound hammer with a chisel in that rock, you're going to be one tired guy at the end of the day. So the conditions at that time were bad.
The conditions were so bad that in the early days, 9 men a year were killed on average in the mines. As technology evolved, miners were equipped with better equipment, but still the conditions were extremely dangerous.
The first drilling machine was the 2-foot drill steel in that hammer. The second drilling machine in here was called a widowmaker. And the reason they called it that, it drills straight up. No water. You had to hand crank that machine. Very difficult. A lot of those men got silicosis, which is about the same as black lung.
The miners were successful in their efforts. Out of the 40 mines in the district, they produced a remarkable amount of copper.
They produced some 8 billion pounds of copper, 3 million ounces of gold, silver, lead, and zinc. All those minerals came out of these mines. In fact, there were some 200 different minerals. But the primary product was copper, and it looks just like that. That's about 25% copper or better right there, and it ranges in all those colors. But it's just a small pocket in this stope, because the rest of the high grade, they mined out of here.
Leaving the stope, we head back down the stairs and onto the train. We travel 1,500 feet more to examine another portion of the mine.
Okay, folks, you gotta get off again to your left. We're gonna walk about 150 feet back into the mine. Please watch your steps.
Jerry has us focus our lights on a wall with dozens of holes drilled out and rigged with about a dozen sticks of dynamite. He explains how the miners use different lengths of fuses to create sequential explosions.
We're going to put 7 sticks of dynamite in each hole with a cap and a fuse at the back. And we're going to tamp it in there with some material that looked like rope. When this rock breaks, we want it to break about 8 to 10 inches in diameter. And there should be about 40 tons laying here when we get through. We're going to make this thing go off the way that we want it to. Now, if I've got a 7-foot hole, I'll use a 12-foot fuse. I'm going to cut 18 inches off the first fuse, use it for a guide. And I'm going to add a 1/4 inch to every fuse that I put them in there.
About an hour and 15 minutes later, we headed back to the outside world. No longer raining, it took our eyes a few seconds to adjust to the sunlight. As we put away our gear, we came across another ex-miner who also guides many of the tours. His name is Neto Chavez. He worked in the mines for 25 years. He says all his life he wanted to be a miner.
Well, I grew up on the hill right across from us. And I used to see the trains coming out of the mine here. And they used to dump the ore out here. So when I was little and I'd say, well, one of these days I want to drive one of the motors. Well, I hung around here enough to where I finally got to work in the mines. And I finally did drive the motors. I started working the mines in 1948. And at that time, I was getting 97 cents an hour. And then when they closed the mines down in 1975, my wages was $6 an hour then.
The mines closed in 1975. The mayor at that time didn't want Bisbee to become a ghost town, so he negotiated with the mine owners and acquired a lease. Since the closure, many of the miners were out of work. They had left Bisbee to find employment, but were unsuccessful. So the miners volunteered to repair the mine so it could be open to the public. The mine area we visited had been closed since 1943 and over the years had been vandalized. It took the miners a year and a half to repair the mine, and in February 1978, the Copper Queen mine tours began. Many of the men have great memories of their time as miners. I asked Neto Chavez to tell me a story about his mining days, and this was his answer.
Ooh, you don't have time enough for all them stories. Back in them days, we used to go to the bars, naturally. And, way back when, this town was quite lively then. There was a lot of bars open there. And then Naco was down here close by. We're only 8 miles from the border. So Saturday night come around, we'd go down there dancing and all that, partying, yeah. It was a lot of fun, yeah. I enjoyed working in the mines, yeah.
The Copper Queen Mine is open for tours 7 days a week at a cost of $12 for adults and $5 for children ages 4 to 15. Reservations can be made by calling 866-432-2071. And now here's Mark McLemore with the Arizona Spotlight Arts Calendar.
In town this weekend, the Tucson Playback Theater does something a little different. They're presenting an evening of audience members' true stories brought to life on stage, a unique form of improvisation at Zuzi's Little Theater in historic YWCA. That's at 738 North 5th Avenue, and that's this Saturday evening at 7:30. Also tomorrow night, Pima County Parks and Rec are helping to present a Harvest Moon celebration at the Ironwood Picnic Area. They're inviting people to come down and stroll along a moonlit desert trail, see night-active animal presentations, hear the sights and sounds of bats in flight, and more, including scoping out full moon craters with telescopes. That's tomorrow night, beginning at 5 at Tucson Mountain Park. Sunday, the Tucson Jazz Society presents Turning Point with their smooth jazz, rock, and world music sounds at St. Philip's Plaza. Also happening this Sunday in the morning, it's a Jazz Sunday presentation at St. Mark's Presbyterian Church, featuring local stars Lisa Otey, Rob Boone on trombone, and Heather Hardy on violin. The new Kiva Motions Puppet Theater presents Aesop's Fables for the kids Saturday and Sunday at the Red Barn Theater at 948 North Main. And remember, tomorrow night, Higher Ground, a relief concert for Hurricane Katrina victims, will be seen on KUAT TV Channel 6 and also heard here on KUAZ starting at 5 tomorrow evening.
It's been over 3 weeks since Hurricane Katrina tore through the Gulf Coast region, destroying nearly everything in its path. And while people are still mourning the loss of life, the loss of homes and possessions, and the loss of jobs, we're also fearing that a unique culture and history will be lost. Mississippi blues, New Orleans jazz, Cajun food, the festivals, will it ever be the same? Louisiana in particular takes great pride in their rich heritage. I think Baxter Black describes it best. Here's his commentary, Cajun Dance.
These girls can dance. And he was right. I was flat in the middle of a magic place. Whiskey River landed on the levee of the Shafalaya Swamp in South Louisiana. The floor was given underneath the dancers. The Hooval family band was driving Cajun music into every crevice and cranny, every pore and fiber, every pop, tinkle, and nail hole, till the room itself seemed to expand under the pressure. The slippers glided, stomped, clicked, and clacked. They stood on their toes, they rocked on their heels, they moved like water skippers on the top of a chocolate swamp, pausing, sliding, setting, pirouetting, leaping from a starting block, breaking to a smooth stop, heaving to boat-like up against a floating pier, and then off again into the blur of circling bare legs, boot tops, and bone temps, all in perfect rhythm to the beating of the bayou heart. I have lived a fairly long time. I have been places. I have seen bears mate, boats sink, and Gila monsters scurry. I have danced till I couldn't stand up and stood up till I couldn't dance. I've eaten bugs, broccoli, and things that crawl on the sea floor. I have seen as far back as Mayan temples, as far away as Betelgeuse, and as deep down as Tom Robbins. I have been on Johnny Carson, the cover of USA Today, and fed the snakes at the Dixie Chicken. I have held things in my hand that will be here a million years beyond my own existence. And yet, on that dance floor, I felt a ripple in the universe, a time warp moment when the often unspectacular human race threw its head back and howled at the moon. Thank you, Napoleon. Thank you, Canadians. And thank you, Shirley Cormier and All Girl Cajun Band. It was a crawfish crab meat carousel, a seafood baldine creole bell, an Acadian accordion, heavy water gumbo, etouffee, Spanish moss jambalaya, and a Tabasco popsicle where you suck the head and eat the tail. My gosh, you can say it again. These girls can dance.
Arizona Spotlight is a production of KUAZ Radio from the University of Arizona and is produced in the KUAZ studios by Jim Blackwood, with production assistance from Ginger Duran. Our executive producer is Peter Michaels. A portion of the music heard on today's program was written and performed by Calexico. I'm Julie Burock.